Dolph Lundgren, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thanks for being on my show, The Art of Action. Dolph, I really appreciate it. My show is about the art of creating action for films, whether it be boxing, martial arts, gunplay. You've done it all. We were working together back in March. We were just started on a film, Castle Falls, and unfortunately we couldn't complete it, could we?
No, we got shut down like everybody else because of COVID-19 after half a day of shooting. Even though you that was a great fight we shot with you in it, MMA gym.
Haven't seen it. Look forward to seeing it.
But I know it's going to be good. I know it's going to be good. And we're going to hopefully be back on set now in about a month, I hope. Finish the picture.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, and I think it's a great little story. It's a good, really great role for you, and it's a kind of solid movie. You know, I think it's cool. You know, it's sort of a thriller, but it has like a good, has a nice heartfelt kind of center, which I like a lot. You know, about it.
Yeah, it's a good script with strong characters, and of course, lots of action.
Yeah, plenty.
Best of everything. That's what we need. Well, Dolph, I know it's a lot, but can you please, for the audience, just tell us what your martial arts background is? And I know it's extensive, so just briefly.
I'll be quick. When I was about 14, 15, I started doing some judo. I was playing ice hockey. I lived in northern Sweden, where everybody plays ice hockey. And I started doing some judo on the side, and I wasn't crazy about it because, you know, I got stuck under some fat guy who was sweating on me, and I was just a kid, you know, so I said, oh, I don't know about this. But I was attracted to martial arts, and I found this book called Karate, and it was by this guy, Attila Mecheros, who's now a chairman of the Kyokushin organization in Europe. But back then, he was like a black belt, and he wrote this book, a little book, and I saw guys, you know, fighting, lifting weights, breaking wood, hitting the bag, and me and my friend started training ourselves. And then I got involved in Goju-Ryu for a little while, which is another Japanese style. And then when I moved to Stockholm, I started training Kyokushin Karate, which is this is like when I was about 16. And my instructor, Brian Fitkin, who is a British national champion, world champion, team world champion with the UK team, back in England team. I started with him. When I was about 20, I started fighting. I did some tournaments, but I started fighting knockdown karate, which is kind of a full contact version so it's kind of close to Thai boxing, but you don't wear any gloves. You only hit to the body, you kick to the head, you can knees to the head, sweeps. You could throw as well, facing the opponent. So you couldn't like turn into a hip throw, but you could like sweep the opponent. So that was kind of new. And Masuyama, who was the founder of Kyokushin Karate, I met him a few times in Tokyo. You know, he passed away about 25 years ago, but I trained with him there. And finally I became kind of good at it. My dad, by the way, was a very brutal guy. I mean, he was smart, but he was abusive towards me. So when I was a kid, I got beat up a lot. And I think I had this sort of attraction to contact sports, you know, to get that kind of pushback, to get that feeling and trying to feel strong.
Do you think you needed that in your life? Do you think you would have maybe gone off the rails without it, or you had a lot of aggression as a kid?
Yeah, I had a lot of aggression, but also a lot of self-destructive type of behavior. They call it escape behavior, where you try to get away from something that's inside you, like PTSD, like soldiers with PTSD. Sometimes they end up hurting themselves, not other people, you know. So I had both. But I mean, karate kind of channeled my energy and my aggression into something positive and constructive. And I started competing in knockdown karate in Sweden, and well, actually couldn't do it in Sweden. It was against the law there, but I did it in the UK and Japan.
See this stuff?
Yes. Yeah, this is from Japan, I believe.
Yeah, I think that's Tokyo 79, is it?
Yeah. And I used to do the knee kick. Yeah, that one.
Knee to the head.
Yeah, that was my favorite. Then they changed the rules that, you know, they got more strict with the knees. Like, you couldn't hang on. And you have to grab a special way because, you know, I used them a lot for knocking people out. And I always felt sorry for my opponent. This guy won he became world champion, this guy Nakamura. Where he fought like in the fourth round. I was just a green belt. Actually, I was a proper green belt, but I almost got him there. Somebody gave me a brown belt because you had to be a brown belt to fight, even though I was only a green belt. But
I was looking at that. It looked like a red belt, but that's brown belt, is it?
Yeah, well, what you do is they put a red sash over it, white and a red. Okay. So when the referees, you know, throw up their little flags here, it's either white or red.
You couldn't punch to the face, you could kick to the head, but I'm sure I think you're getting punched in the face a few times in this.
Well, fight. I did by this guy because he cheated a lot. He actually, in the fight before me, he knocked out this Hawaiian guy, broke his teeth, his front teeth. So it was funny because I'm fighting this guy and he's not following the rules, but he was the favorite to win. Quite famous fighter in Japan. And Brian Fitkin keeps telling me, you know, knock him out, you know, punch him in the face, kick him in the groin. But I couldn't do it because Masayama was sitting down there and I didn't want to, like, you know, get disqualified. So we fought like three extensions and I eventually lost. But I think I made a pretty good impression. And also it taught me that I could possibly win a tournament. And the next year I won British Open and then I won in 81 as well. Yeah, this is back in Japan, I think, as well. This is training with Matsui, who was the world champion in 1983. I trained with him. And this is at dojo in Tokyo.
Well, I remember the first time I met you was in Bulgaria, and I came over to do Ninja, and you were there. I think, I can't remember the film that you were making, but you were there. It might have been Command Performance. But anyway, I remember staying at the same hotel and seeing you in the garden training with a guy doing your Kyokushin. Yes. Barefisted in the garden there, smashing each other's faces. I was like, oh, Dolph's the real deal then.
Yeah, that was my friend Slavi, who became world champion. He was light heavyweight. He was a tough guy. Yeah, I've kept it up over the years. I got my third. I got my third degree black belt like about 20 years ago, and then I got my fourth just last year. But that was I didn't do a grading for the fourth. Third, I had fights and everything. But
we just awarded the fourth down.
I was awarded. Yeah, I've done four or five exhibitions at the World Tournament in Tokyo over the years. So, you know, and I think I've supported the style quite well, the kitchen, so they give to me. Most of my friends are six times and up because they have their own schools in Sweden most of the time.
Amazing. Lifelong martial artist. Us.
Thank you. Us. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, it's, I miss it. I don't do a lot of karate now. I'll do some kata, some forms, but I do mostly, you know, weights, fitness, a little bit of boxing. I had some hip surgery, so I try not to do a lot of kicks. And it's not like I miss it, but I don't miss it. You know, like I've done enough kicks for five lifetimes, but I miss that camaraderie in the dojo. I miss that part of it.
Yeah, I wish I'd stayed with a traditional martial art. Taekwondo moved into kickboxing, and then I didn't really go back to anything traditional, and I miss that, and I regret it in some ways. But
well, you know, now it's all free for all, and it's. I think style doesn't really matter. It's more how, you know, your attitude and how you carry yourself. I think that's important, and because, you know, it's supposed to be something that strengthens your character, not just physically, but psychologically, emotionally, and makes you a better person, which I think with some of the non-traditional arts, they forget that part. It's all about fighting, but, you know, the person has not evolved at all. And And that's sad to see sometimes.
Just the act of bowing to go into the dojo and, you know, bowing to your sensei and bowing to your partners, just that act in itself is, you know, does a lot, especially for kids, I think, and the traditions that you learn through traditional martial arts are very important.
I think it's great. Well, you have very, you're very well behaved. You have very good manners, you know, so you pick that up. But some guys in MMA, you know, they don't. I mean, maybe it is the show, I don't know. But, you know, if you think about it, I think a lot of that samurai, etiquette, it really comes from the fact that originally when you went in for a duel, it was to the death. Only one guy would survive. Yeah. So with that in mind, say you have a family or something, with that in mind, you're going to come into that, in that situation, in a different frame of mind than if it's just a game, you know. And I think that it's nice to keep a little bit of that.
So how did you get into the film business?
It was, I guess, meant to be. I was in Australia and I was working doing security for rock concerts with a friend of mine who was my sparring partner, a boxer actually, and we were doing security, and there was this one act, Grace Jones, who was a African-American singer from Jamaica, but she lived in New York, and we both got picked out to sort of do security when she went out partying afterwards with her entourage, and somehow we ended up back in her hotel room. There was like 20 people, and there was like 10, then there was 8, then there was like 4, then it was me, my friend, her, and maybe her manager. Then he took off and finally ended up with her, you know, by myself. And it was like I started realizing why I was picked out in the first place. And I spent, you know, the next day I missed a few classes. This is in Sydney, Australia. I ended up falling in love with her. And when I went to train in Japan, she was there doing a commercial. We met again. I was training with Oyama. And I moved to New York, and instead of going to MIT to study engineering, I had 6 months off, and I ran into Andy Warhol, Michael Jackson, all of these people. And
did you have 54?
And finally, you know, I started kind of going, I don't know about chemical engineering. This is kind of interesting. The show
business. Too much fun.
Too much fun. So I started studying. I did some modeling to get a work permit, and then a visa. And then somebody said, hey, man, you can fight. You look pretty good. You should, you know, you could be in the movies maybe. You know, you should try it.
No one ever said that to me. They were like, you can't be in the movies.
No, but they did, but they didn't know what they were talking about. Basically, I was studying acting, and I realized that, you know, when I got on stage, even though I was an amateur, of course, I had no experience, I liked it. It was something about being emotional in front of people and opening up that I, obviously, it got back to my childhood and my dad and all of that. So I decided to give it a shot. And pretty soon, I was up for a couple of movies. And within like 6-7 months, I think, I was up for Rambo 2 that I pitched. Yeah. I got a part in Rambo 2, but at the same time, I was auditioning for this boxing movie. I didn't know what it was, but it was Rocky 4. And Stallone, I met him here in LA. They flew me out to LA and I met with him and had to put on some weight, lift. So I started doing bodybuilding, where I put on about 5-6 kilos, maybe. I was quite skinny. I was about 90 kilos when I fought, you know.
No, yeah, upper body. Even in the karate video there, you're a lot thinner.
Yeah, big legs and no upper body, you know, just wiry. And then I put on some weight and auditioned for out here in Los Angeles. In 1984, it was December, and I against two other Russian guys who were up for the same role, and I got that role in Rocky IV.
A normal heavyweight averages 700 pounds of pressure per square inch.
So hang on, 5 months of training. Take me through what the training was.
Okay, when I showed up, I got two scripts. I got the script of the movie, and then I got another script that was about 40 pages of those two fights, and especially the one with Stallone, where everything was written out, like left, 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 right, left hook, you know, I had to memorize this, which I did.
And, so Stallone written that out, the whole fight scene in his
head?
He
wrote down the whole fight. He had written it all down.
Like Morse code.
No, and he, you know what? He had all the music written already. So when we trained, we were training to the music. So it's pretty, I mean, I was just a kid, but I realized he was very methodical, a very smart guy. And basically morning, 9 o'clock, we lifted weights for about an hour, 6 days a week. You know, did a split schedule, chest and back.
Did you do it with Stallone? You're doing it together?
With Stallone, yeah, every day. And then in the afternoon around 2, I used to drive home, have some lunch to my modest apartment that I had. I mean, living by myself, renting a car. And then I would drive at 2 o'clock to boxing, which there was a gym they built around very close to MGM in those days, down in Culver City, which was just for the movie, where they had a ring and bags and everything. We trained there. We would do choreography or a little bag work for about an hour. And then between 2 and 3 or 2 and 3.30 and something like that. And then go home, eat dinner, and then...
Did they give you a nutritionist in terms of...
No. They didn't. I had already talked to a bodybuilder when I was in London. Actually, I was with Grace, who was doing A View to a Kill, Bond movie in London. So I'd spoken to this bodybuilder. I didn't know much about nutrition, but he put me on this pretty strict diet that was extremely boring. Everything, it was the same meals every day, 7 days a week, you know, for 6 months. Yeah. But I didn't give a shit, really. I didn't care.
And you've been you've been on the same diet for the last 30 years.
Well, I was till about 5 years ago. I think I was the same diet. You too, right? Same diet for 30 years. I'm a little now, I you know, as you get older, you can eat more and you can, you know, it's more like I feel now I got to eat more calories and I can have pasta and things. It doesn't matter because automatically you get more, less body fat and more, I mean, why we are more cut. Well, I do anyway. As you get older. I don't get fat. No, I get more.
Oh my God. See, this is why you're some sort of genetic freak.
No, it's almost I'm more muscular. I'm just thinking if I don't eat enough, if I put myself on a strict diet now, I would just get sick. I don't think my nervous system could handle the lifting weights, fighting, and being on a hard diet. Yeah. It's like I have to give one up, and I would rather eat. I mean, I'm eating clean, but I eat more. I don't eat like, you know what it's like when you punish yourself and you eat no salt, no sugar, just protein for like.
Was actually talking to Stallone about this very thing, and he was talking about how he would really, you know, drop his body fat down so far, and then he would do these fight scenes, and he would compromise his immune system, and he'd be injury prone because of it, and it was like a vicious circle of just completely destroying yourself.
30 years, same thing. You're dehydrating. I mean, we did that for Rocky IV. I learned from Stallone some of the things. You just drink Diet Coke. You don't drink water. You just eat protein and you dehydrate and you lose the water between your muscles and your skin, right? So you get very dry and very cut. But obviously if you get tired and you're pushing your body, you're going to get some injuries sooner or later.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're 26 years old, that's one thing.
You can get away with
46 or 56.
So, yeah. Did you learn the fight from beginning to end then? You could have done the whole thing in one shot.
Yes, could have. I could have, yeah. I knew everything. I still remember some of it. I remember the opening was like 6 jabs, right hand left hook. That I remember. But I could have done the whole thing. What I didn't know was, movie boxing, which means, you got to go... It's close, but you can't hit the guy. But at the same time, it has to look real. Then you have to learn to snap your head. All those things. I didn't know that, so I had to pick it up.
How many cameras were there filming at any one time?
There were 9 cameras.
Wow. Sometimes you can see the cameras, people in the crowd with cameras. Were those actually cameras that were film cameras, or were they?
Probably, actors? Yeah. Probably. Yeah. They did that same in Creed too, where they have news photographers and camera crews in the movie are actually real cameras and they're using them. It's easier now with HD, but in those days, it's all film. So they had 3 cameras, handheld through the ropes. They had 3 kind of medium and then 3 back far back, you know, wide. So in other words, you know, you got a shitload of footage, of course, 35 millimeter film you have to organize and put it together. But yeah, more or less, you could probably get a hit from any angle.
Did you ever think, okay, we're going to do this specifically for this camera? Or was it a case of, we can try and get what we get from all these cameras, and because you've got the gloves on, we're going to get closer than we normally would?
It would be both. We would do some of it we just run half the round with 9 cameras, and then, you know, maybe do some specialty stuff where, like, when I really hit him and he goes down, which perhaps, you know, we do that for 1 camera. No pain, remember? No pain, no pain.
Yeah. This guy's great.
Yeah. So this is the beginning of the fight. So there's 6 jabs. Yeah. 1, 2, 3. Okay, he cuts them out. But
yeah.
Yeah, because it wasn't this, they made me go at him quicker. In the original, there was a little more moving around, but he cut that out. And then, you know, some of this stuff, obviously, this is back in the day when everything was real and there were no CGI, there was no way to fix things afterwards, pretty much. So you have to be pretty close with the shots. You have to be pretty close. And the problem was, when I first started training with him, Stallone was getting he was getting divorced at the time. So he'd show up in a suit with a couple of bodyguards, and I'd be waiting for him in the gym, in the boxing gym, and he wouldn't be in a good mood, you know.
Oh, no.
And in a bad mood, and I had to. And he'd say, closer, get closer. And then if I tapped him, he'd go, "Fucking hit me again, I'll fire us," or something like that.
When you were actually shooting this, did it ever get quite intense between the pair of you? Or was it?
Yeah, well, it did. But I mean, obviously, he was my, you know, mentor and boss. And,
yeah.
You know, he's a big movie star.
But when you're in the thick of it, you're getting so close to each other. There must have been some accidents.
And some of those dives or like hits he's absorbing are pretty... I mean, it just happened in the moment. We didn't plan for him to go flying through the air. He just did that. And I think why the fight why the movie kind of endures, I mean, apart from it being very well put together, I think because the fight it's realistic, but it's a little larger than life. And yet it is, you know, believable. And I think that fine line is why it's fun to watch.
For round 2, it's been a one-sided fight so far.
It'll take more than luck for Rocky to survive this round. Rocky's been hit with bombs.
Now, I was just watching my karate stance. You know how this long stance you can see here for a boxer? You see how my...
Yeah.
It's kind of a long... See that? Like a long stance, which is more karate than boxing, where Stallone has his feet close together.
Had you boxed before this?
Yes, I had. I was studying boxing in New York, and I had this crazy idea before I got this film that I was going to become a fighter, because I went to Gleason's gym, and some guy watched me fight and thought, hey, here's a white guy who can fight, you know, yeah. Great white hope. So they're trying to sign me, and I got smart enough and decided not to do it, and then I ended up in the movie instead. But it was quite close. Right. But I remember first time I walked in the gym, and I was hitting a bag, you know. And, you know, I guess I had presence, you know. I didn't know that, but I mean, I was this big, blonde guy, Swedish guy with short hair, and, you know, moved pretty well and hitting the bag. And this little black kid came up and tapped me on the shoulder, my 13, 14-year-old, and I said, yeah, what is it? He pointed across the gym. There was this big black guy, maybe 240. And he says, that guy, he wants to kick your ass. And I never forgot it. I was like, okay, this is not martial arts anymore. This is different.
I was just watching it this morning, you know, and I've seen it so many times, but just watching a little bit of it as I was putting it together, I just suddenly got so engrossed into it and so captivated and so pumped up. And all of the Rocky films are like that. They're just so incredible for motivation, and just there's something about it. What is it about the Rocky films that just gets people so pumped up?
I think what it is with the Rocky movies is that it's like Stallone says, you don't have to know anything about boxing to enjoy a Rocky movie, because it's not about boxing, it's about life. It's about, you know, what we all go through in our fights that we go through in our lives to try to find happiness and try to find some inner peace and feel good about ourselves. It's about that. It's more philosophical than, you know, really about boxing, even though they're very well put together, of course, and that helps. But I think it is the well-drawn characters in it and the fact that Stallone has a way of always, you know, you know how it's going to go, but he still kind of gets you and you still start going, well, holy, he's gonna lose this one, you know, and you're not. Yeah. You realize, like, oh, shit, but he gets you somehow. Like, yeah, in that underdog kind of, you know, with an underdog character, Rocky Balboa, and we all, most of us have that feeling of being an underdog and trying to prove things to ourselves and to the world. I think that's what the movies are so huge.
Yeah, and he's, the way he plays Rocky is very vulnerable, isn't it? And you really care for the guy. And the way you play Ivan Drago, I mean, that's one of the most intimidating villains, I think, in cinematic history, especially with the black gum shield back then. And when you start getting the swelling around your eyes, it turns you even more evil.
It was a very intimidating character. And of course, Stallone made him more intimidating editing, and also by cutting out a lot of the dialogue, which I think some of it's going back into the, there's a director's cut coming out in November. I think he told me, sent me some footage and I looked at it. But
how cool is that? That's something to look forward to.
Yeah, I think I'm up to about 5 lines of dialogue in all movies instead of 2. But but on the other hand, you know, some of the most memorable movie lines, Play It Again, Sam, or it's Make My Day, or it's I'll Be Back, or I Must Break You. I mean, they're all, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. What do people ask you to say more? I Must Break You, or If He Dies, He Dies?
Yeah, a little bit of both, you know. Or, yeah, most of those two. Sometimes, yeah, If He Dies, He Dies is a good one. But I Must Break You is the one where a lot of people like,
I Must Break You.
I Must Break You. You know,
brilliant, man. It must have been quite something for you, though, to be going into Rocky IV, knowing how successful all the other three were, and thinking, man, this is my first real acting job. It's a massive role in this huge film.
Well, it was a massive role. The thing is, I was lucky because auditioned for it, didn't get the role. I was too tall. Well, they didn't even audition me. They just said, you're too tall. So I had some pictures of me in boxing gear, and I took my motorcycle one night when I was having dinner with this director, John Hertzfeld, who's a good friend of Stallone's. And he said, oh, I can give Stallone the pictures. So I drove down, you know, Third Avenue, whatever it was, back up, got the pictures, gave them to him. And then I met Stallone. And then I had like 5 or 6 months to work on the character and figure out, you know, make decisions like he shouldn't move too much. He should be very internal. He shouldn't yell and scream and be very like, I Must Break You. He should be very internal and work on the Soviet kind of that high chin that all the cadets have, all the soldiers, mm-hmm. to have that sort of workers, hero of the Soviet Union kind of look. And I had a chance to work on all of that. And then I auditioned for it. So there was a lot of pressure. I had to audition on film here in California. So once I had the role, I already had it down to some degree. And then they gave me a Russian coach to help me with a Russian accent. And he was a film director from Moscow. So he helped me with some of the delivery and some of the inner life of the character. Because what's interesting about Drago is that you hate him, but you kind of get a feeling that he's this guy who's been used and, you know, by the system. And there's all this other shit clicking in his head that, you know, where he feels embarrassed for doing certain things. And so people kind of got inside his head. And that was a lot of that work.
Especially the moment when he's rising up in the ring.
And yeah, that's
you
a good
see
one.
He's kind of lost, like, what the hell's going on here? This is all above my head.
Capitalist America. Yeah, there is there's some subtleties in the performance that even though I was an amateur, I had people helping me, and I was lucky enough that those subtleties made the character very human, even though he was non-human, but he was a person.
Victor.
Creed 2 was an amazing performance by you. Fabulous acting performance. And really, in that movie, I felt like your character was the character that really had the heart and emotion. You know, it was that can make you weep what you were going through there, especially the ending bit. No, it was very emotional.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree. I knew that. I mean, I knew when we shot the ending, and I could look in the audience and saw that the extras were crying, the women. I knew it was going to be good. And because, you know, there's this thing about sons and fathers that, you know, a lot of us have various degrees of that kind of some conflict. And I think a lot of the women are on the sidelines and they just have to watch it happen. And they feel it upsets them too, but they can't do anything about it. So I think what the writer, the two African-American guys who wrote the script, they, you know, they grew up in the hood and they were... I know, because I spoke to Stephen Caple, the director, and he said, you know, I grew up in the hood in Cleveland. So, you know, the characters that I like to work on in this movie were, of course, Yvonne and Victor, who have nothing. They're poor, you know, they don't have a pot to piss in, and they live in, like, you know, Ukraine, and they're like, they have no money. They have, you know, those are the characters that I think, you know, the audience, it's easy to start sympathizing with them. Even though they're bad guys, you know.
The Nuspers, the deal with regularly.
Round 4 is another brutal display. As Creed takes a lot of punishment.
Well, you know, I didn't want to do the movie because I thought, oh, we're going to use Ivan Drago as a bad guy, you know. So, you know, like a communist, you know, like a caricature. So I didn't want to do it. And only when I read the script, because Stephen Caple said, no, wait for my script. I started reading an early version that was terrible, where Victor was using the N-word, you know, to you know, Michael B. Jordan, which is like, yeah. Can't do that, man. I'm just like, they can't do that. But then I read the second draft, which was Caple's draft. And at the end, you know, when I realized that Ivan Drago in this, this latest version of him, the old bitter guy, he's the last guy in the world who's going to throw in the towel, right? Everybody, 7 billion people, and then there's Drago at the bottom. He's not going to throw in the towel. So when he does at the end, and when you as an audience have forgotten that there is that rule in boxing, you can throw in the towel, but we've forgotten. But we have seen that little clip when Rocky didn't throw it in for Apollo. Yeah, yeah. So that circle, whoever came up with that, was brilliant. Because how can you not get emotionally, you know, attached to that moment. So no, it was a good role. That was great. Thanks. I'm glad you liked it. I liked it too a lot. There's a lot of big action scenes, and they had real explosions. I mean, explosives. Yeah. Look at that. I mean, it's crazy. There, you know, all of this stuff was serious. Like, you know, South African dynamite they used there. The South African Special Forces were my instructors, and they used some of the effects. They actually blew up for real, and nobody cared. You know, people got scared. I played this Russian guy again here. I was in pretty good shape. I had a guy who whose job was to measure how much water I drank every day. And it was like supposed to be, I don't know, 20 ounces, whatever it was, or 40 ounces. And I always went up to him and said, hey, give me some more water. He said, no, you already had 28 ounces. And I said, no, I didn't. He said, yes, you did. And I said, give me the water. And then I end up fighting with this kid all the time. You know, this poor South African guy.
Look at this bit here. This guy gets his hat blown off.
Yeah, these are real. They used real, you know, little pieces of dynamite and C4 here. And it's people crazy. Got very upset. The makeup crew from London, and they got very upset because basically, you know, when the explosion went off, your chest got compressed, you know, like far away, like in the makeup trailer. So it was crazy. There's one scene when I'm being followed by a hyena, when I'm like staggering around the desert and the hyena actually bit me, and I got a little upset, and they had some kind of guard on set who had a pistol, like the load, the loaded gun, and I went up to was going to pull his gun out, and I told the trainer, next time I'm going to have to put this creature down, and he was like, don't hurt my hyena.
I'm going to have to put this creature down.
Yeah,
it's big explosions, isn't it, this one? It's like the Russian Rambo, but it looks like it's pretty dicey, pretty hairy.
It was, yeah. It was all the stuff I did there. You have to really watch your back. And I also did this transfer from a motorcycle to a truck where I did the jump myself. I remember that. Because I had nothing to do that day. I was just bored.
Well, how long, this would have been your first film used in a lot of weaponry. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was the first time I had a gun, actually, in the movie. Because in Masters of the Universe, I just had a sword, I guess. So, it was interesting. I mean, I trained with the South African Special Forces, and they were really tough guys. They were all from Rhodesia. But, they had this camo paint that that I used. That was real camo paint that is made to stay on during real battle conditions. It stays on for like a couple of weeks. So we shot those scenes for, maybe for 2 weeks, and I had it on my face, on my arms and legs. So I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go anywhere, really. I was just in my hotel room,
I think after Studio 54, you would have been fine with anything, I would have thought.
That's right, yeah. No, I'd already done it. <You know? laughs>
It's him! Move it for a close-up! Get a close-up!
I got it!
That's a film that I watched a lot, man. I was a big fan of the comic book. Massive fan of the comic book. When you got that part, were you aware how big that comic book was?
I wasn't aware. They gave me the comic books. I wasn't a comic book fan, so I didn't really know. Yeah. I went to Australia, and we had some of the same people I did Mad Max and Road Warrior did the costumes, and you can tell there's some resemblance. And they flew in these two fighters in Tokyo who played these two Japanese bad guys who I had fights with. And they were like, the first guy, when they first showed up at the studio, I was already training there. Brian was there, Brian Pitcher. And I had this, leather, these big boots and these leather outfit that was really tight. Like, it was really hard to kick, heavy boots and all that. But the first thing one guy did was, he said in Japanese, Mawashigeri, show me a kick, kick my hand. So I kicked his hand, and they both thought it was like a real fight. Like, I was there fighting them. They both got very upset, especially the younger guy.
Is this in the red room? Is this in the red room?
Yeah, the red room. The guy who I stabbed, who I killed with a spear, he was crying. He thought he was dishonored his family back in Japan by dying in this movie, and he was really upset. He didn't want to do it. They have to really convince him to, do it. And also the other guy, that was the big guy who became the world champion, Kenji Yamaki. The other guy, Hitoshi, I think his name was Hiroshi, we had this one scene when there was something with I have some kind of weapon and he is supposed to break it with a kick. But for some reason they messed up. We had no breakaway, so they were all broken already. So he just said, don't worry, it's okay. So we just used a real sword and he kicked it in half.
But is it you coming down the zip line or not? Is that you or
something? I think I did some of it. I think I did some of that for sure. I can't remember how much, but the guy who wrote it, Robert Kamen, he wrote Karate Kid and also Aiken and the writer. He was a Gojiru guy. Yeah, I couldn't do, if I did half of the stuff, I'd be in the hospital for like a month.
Was it nice for you to have the opportunity to show your martial arts for the first time?
You're right. Yeah, that's it. It was pretty much the first time I did martial arts. Yeah, it was fun. I was in Sydney for 4 months, training with all the Kyokushin guys there, and had those fights on camera with those two crazy Japanese guys. And it was good. I remember both Brian and I, we both caught some kind of Australian flu So we couldn't think straight for about 3 months. They have the worst flu down there, and you have no resistance if you're not from Australia.
You should be good for COVID now, then.
I should, yeah. Well, I think it goes away after 25 years, but anyway.
What's happened here? This looks like it's gone wrong.
You see, all that chain.
And the face.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes, as you know, the stunt guys get nervous and, you know they're going to have to take a hit or a kick, and they tense up, and sometimes they hurt you instead. I mean, I'm sure you've been there many times.
Yeah. Was it a real chain? Looks pretty real.
Yeah, I think it was. Pretty sure it was.
It looked good, so that's the most important thing. Pain is temporary, right?
It is. And, you know, it's like the Vikings, they try to get immortality. And, you know, that was their whole thing, was called word fame, where you were famous after your life was over. People still talked about you then. That was worth everything. And that's why, if you had if you needed volunteers for some dangerous mission, where they, you know, had 20 Vikings, all 20 of them go, okay, I'll go. Yeah. And I think that I have something that like that in me, and I'm sure you do too. Like, you know, we're willing to take a pound of flesh, you know, out of our bodies to reach some kind of fame, or to entertain people, or to feel good about yourself, whatever it is. It's a combination that we're, you know.
I'm just trying to make sure I get the next job.
Me too. Yeah. Well, that was part of it. But within that, there's some kind of thing that I've had anyway, which is a little bit of not a death wish, but something where if somebody asked me to do something a little crazy, I would, especially those days, I would like to say yes. But now, hopefully, I'm going to say no.
Yeah.
Too old for that shit, as they say.
It's a classic, man. It's a cult classic because it's a little bit cheesy, and some of it, you know, you might be laughing at it for the wrong reasons in some places, but it's got a hell of a lot of charm. And you and Brandon Lee together was great.
Yeah, it was, you're right. It was a bit cheesy and a bit over the top. And I haven't seen it in many years. I don't think I've seen the scenes since I shot it. Well, maybe once, but...
Yeah, you keep the coffee in your hand with the pinky up.
I don't know. This is in the script, I guess. I remember the producer, he told me the story that he had spoken to the director and said, "Hey, Mark, aren't you going to talk to the actors?" And Mark turned and said, "About what?"
Brilliant.
So there you go. That's as much drama was in this picture. But, you know, Brandon was a great guy, very talented, like screen presence. And I'm sure he would have been a big star if he hadn't gotten killed in a strange way. You know, here it's crazy. I look like such a kid. It's like, I look like my daughter.
How old are you there? About 30 or
30? Yeah, 30 or something like that. Yeah.
In fantastic shape in this one. I don't think it's ripped, but big as well.
I think I was pretty much maybe the biggest for Masters. And then in this film, because I had to do more fighting, I got a little more ripped, a little more, you know, cut. Shit, I haven't seen this in ages. You know, this guy, what's his name, that actor?
Gary Tagawa.
Tagawa.
Yeah.
I think I've killed him in 3 movies now over 30 years.
Bridge of Dragons,
this, and then there was some other film he was in as well.
Did this guy bring it back to the judo days with those big heavy people lying on you and sweating on you?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not crazy about that at all. here he is.
Now, I watched this film so much as a kid. I absolutely loved it.
Wow.
It's good fun though, you know. It's funny. It's got a lot of humor in it as well. It's a good time.
Yeah, I haven't seen it for. I haven't seen this as I shot it.
Yeah.
I Kenny, I can't remember this. All I remember is that when we first started training together for the movie, Brandon, I knew this kid, Brandon Lee, was in the picture, somebody told me. I didn't know it was Bruce Lee's son. I just thought, oh, Brandon Lee, some Chinese guy. And then we showed up for this training session, and Ryan was there, my instructor. He had an instructor. I can't remember who it was. It was one of these, Ed Parker, maybe. It was somebody like LA-based karate guy. And then, you know, Brandon got impressed by Brian because he was like fifth dan, whatever he was. And then he asked Brian, you know, Brian's very, very honest, but yeah, Brandon did some techniques and said, what do you think? You know, what do you think of my, what do you think of my techniques? And Brian just looked and said, well, if I were you, I would stick to kicking, he said, because basically his hand techniques are really weak. And I see Brandon, what do you mean? What do you mean? He says, stick to kicking. And then in the movie, he mostly does kicking. I think he somehow is sunk in.
But he was training under Dan Innocento, right? So maybe I feel like he would have been better with the trapping.
Yeah, the trapping. Maybe Innocento was the guy. No, it was somebody else. It was Innocento, but it was somebody else who was with it. Pat Morita. It was a Western guy. But anyway, somebody who was his coordinator. Friend of Bruce Lee's. I can't remember the guy's name now.
Okay.
Anyway, but nice kid. Movie looks a bit geeky, you're right. It does.
Yeah, but you know, look, if you watch that at the right age, it's absolutely incredible.
Kenner, just in case we get killed, I wanted to tell you, you have the biggest dick I've ever seen on a man.
Thanks.
Yeah, so who came up with the immortal line?
It was, you know what, I think it was in the script. I think it was in the script, or maybe it was Brandon who came up with it.
That is a very funny line.
In between cooking cycles, you're supposed to baste us. That's right, you fucking idiots.
So okay, Universal Soldier, I have to say, you run away with the movie. You steal the film. I don't know, this is probably your second time playing the villain. To be honest, I feel like me and you are similar in the way that we really enjoy playing a bad guy part. Can you speak to that?
Well look, I read an interview with, I think it was William Dafoe, where somebody said, you know, why do you play the villain all the time? And he, you know, Academy Award nominated, possibly winning or maybe nominated actor, at least nominated. He says, you know, it's funny. He says, in the movies, usually, many times the guy who plays the villain is the nicest guy on set, whereas the guy who plays the hero is a complete maniac, mean, vengeful, you know. And yeah. I'm not saying that's true for you and me, but there's something in there that, I don't know, if you're a nice guy in real life, it's almost like you have more fun playing a bad guy. And if you're a crazy guy in real life, you want to prove something and you want to, you know, be loved by everybody. And I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I like playing the villain. I like playing, but I like playing somebody who is, you know, multidimensional, whether you're a good guy or a bad guy. Obviously.
It's fun though, isn't it? It's fun to have the outrageous lines and be more theatrical and have more fun with it. You can really get your teeth into it, can't you?
Yes, you can. And a lot of times also the villain is the one who, you know, who initiates the action. If there wasn't for the bad guy, it wouldn't be a movie. Usually, so there's something, you know, active about being a villain. You're as dramatically, you're reactive, but.
Well, did you have a conversation with the director about how over the top you should be? Because you're very over the top, but it works. It completely works.
I had a conversation. It was Roland Emmerich who did, you know, a bunch of big movies after that. I thought the only way to make the guy work would to be over the top, because, you know, it wasn't the greatest script, but, you know, I remember I went in there to see the Roland the first time. I think I was wearing some kind of Indian feathers, because I decided that the guy, see those feathers that in Vietnam, the guy's gone nuts. So I went in there and I did some kind of howl like an eagle or something like that, some shriek like an eagle in his office. And I remember he looked at me, Roland, like he's this German guy smoking cigarettes going, okay, this is sort of interesting. Yes, I like it. And then him and Dean Devlin, they made the character, you know, obviously psychotic and crazy, which I think it worked. I mean, it was entertaining anyway.
When Van Damme kicks you here, is he on a trampoline?
Let me see. I can't remember if he was.
He jumps high there, doesn't he?
Yeah, it looks like something like the double takeoff. Yeah, I think it is a trampoline, yeah. Like a small one. Yeah, he did have very good kicks, and I was impressed by him. I remember he was very smart with the choreography. And the first scene we did was a scene in Vietnam where, you know, we both kill each other, and he kicks his gun out of my hand. But we hadn't met him before. I didn't know him. And we showed up to rehearse and I stuck the gun out. He really whacked it like really hard with his boots. So I just picked up the gun second time, whacked it again. So I turned to Brian and Brian was right there. And so he went up and told Vic Armstrong, you know, the stunt coordinator, big time stunt coordinator, saying, you know, Vic, you know, if Van Damme kicks Dolph one more time like that, Dolph's going to have to knock him out. I'm just telling you now, just so you know. So then I saw Vic walked over to Van Damme and talked to him. The next kick was like, it was like a kiss by a, you know.
Was that day number one? Day number one on the set of
Universal. Day number one. Yeah, it was day number one, scene number one. No, it was, but then after that, we became friendly and we've done a lot of movies together and he's been very nice. I mean,
well, can you talk about the infamous at Cannes, when you had the fight on the red carpet, the pushing thing, that was a publicity stunt, right?
That was sort of a publicity stunt. I was there, I was with my ex-wife, we were engaged, I think, and we were driving, and we had two cars, two Mercedes, we're going to the red carpet, and Van Damme pulls over, and I pull over, and he says, I get this idea, you know, listen, we're going to do this. You're going to push me and I push you back, you know, it'd be like for a fight, you know? And then of course, then when it happened, it got a little bit out of control. Cause I don't know if I forgot about it. Maybe I thought it was a serious and he really pushed me and I really hit him and he went flying, of course, and into a bunch of the security guys.
So it was a publicity stunt that almost went real.
Yeah, almost.
Okay. The fight scene that you have with Van Damme in Regeneration, I think it's a brilliantly staged fight. They choreographed it really well. Probably the Bulgarian stunt team did that, but John Hyams, who I personally think is a really brilliant director.
I agree.
The way he chose to shoot this action sequence, I think is brilliant. What I love about it is the cause and effect of things smashing through walls, smashing through all this stuff. I think it's an excellent fight scene.
Yeah, you know, John is a very... He's a great director, underrated. I don't know why he's not directing more movies now.
Exactly.
I agree. You know, this is a great fight scene where, you know, the stunt guys went through hell when they went through all these walls. I remember that. And I have to go through it with Van Damme at the end. There's one last thing. I think it's right here, that one. That we have to do some of that. But
that hit in the head is funny. Yeah.
No, it's very good. I mean... Hyams is, you're right, he's super talented and
he really is, he's a fabulous director.
And I don't know what the hell, you know, what he's not doing anymore. He's doing TV now.
I've seen the TV show, I've watched it, and it's brilliant. He does a great job. And can I just say that you have had some great death scenes. I think this is probably the best one.
You know, my monologue, I forgot, I just give one word here, isn't it?
You've been trying to tell him something the whole time, and now you suddenly remember. And that's what makes it so good. You remember what you had to tell him, and he's like, I don't want to hear it. Bang. And that's what makes John Hyams so good. He's got a sick sense of humor.
Man, yeah, he's... That one fight in the... picture we did. Same character, so he's like psychotic.
Yeah, I remember you on the day just going absolutely crazy, just trying different things, experimenting, going big. It was very funny. I was trying to keep a straight face.
Yeah, well, yeah, if you go big, you gotta go really big and then see what sticks, right?
But it works, especially for this character. That's what he needs to be. Because he doesn't give a shit about dying, does he? It's just like, okay.
No.
You don't mind getting killed then, Dolph?
No.
You've got no ego about that. Because some action stars do, right?
A lot of people do. Yeah, I think there's two types. There's the type that doesn't mind because they're a little more removed from it, perhaps.
Yeah,
or they need the money, so they do it anyway. Or there is the other type that absolutely refuses to die because somehow they're immortal. But I think in the big picture, in the long-term scheme of things, I don't think it really matters. I think it's, you know, if you entertain people, you entertain people. And
we should let the audience in on a secret.
Yeah.
It's all pretend. It doesn't matter.
Right. It doesn't matter. But, you know, they love it. And I think if you entertain them and if you really go all the way and if you're on and you try to give an honest performance, they're going to like you in there. And that's why we're doing it, I guess. To support ourselves and to sort of be loved or be liked or to be appreciated. So whether you do it dying or not, it doesn't really matter to me.
Brilliant stuff, Dolph.
Yeah.
Listen, man, thanks so much for doing this. You are one of the most recognizable action stars on the planet. Been doing it for a good while now.
Even without glasses.
There you go. If he dies, he dies.
Well, thanks, man. No, it's interesting how I ended up being this action guy all these years. I didn't really plan it that way, but I guess it was my karma, my destiny to end up becoming that guy.
You're very good at it, Dolph. So that's one of the main reasons. But listen, man, I've done a few films with you and it's always a pleasure. You're a great guy. And I look forward to being back on set with you, hopefully soon, fingers crossed, for Castle Falls.
Thanks, Scott. Same to you. You're always great to work with and you're a professional. And look forward to doing this other picture with you now pretty soon, I guess. So, we'll see you soon.
Thanks a lot.
And thanks for this great show you're doing. I think I think people are going to love it. It's a great format.
Thanks, Dolph. Yeah, I really enjoy it. It's been keeping me busy.
All right, man.